Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hello, hello. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. We're focusing today on a topic that relates to some of the biggest damages in medical malpractice cases, and that's when something goes wrong in the obstetrical area. We know that babies can be born with catastrophic injuries requiring an enormous amount of medical support to keep them alive. And our guest today is Savannah June, who has experience in the maternal fetal medicine area. She has experience also in labor and delivery, in fetal monitoring, in high-risk OB for a total of 14 years. And as a legal nurse consultant, she focuses on maternal fetal medicine cases, obstetrical cases, and those factors that can result in bad outcomes in OB. Savannah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I know that many of our listeners may be approached by attorneys with obstetrical cases. For the reasons that I've just outlined, these can be enormously compelling cases, not only when something goes wrong with the baby, but also with the mother. I know that people know the term obstetrical care. What is maternal fetal medicine as a term?
So maternal fetal medicine is actually a subspecialty of obstetric care. So maternal fetal medicine specialists are sometimes called perinatologists or MFMs. The MFM doctors that I work with went to school to be OBGYNs, and they had an additional three-year fellowship after that to take care of just very high-risk pregnant patients. So the maternal fetal medicine doctors are the ones that do all of the 3D and 4D ultrasounds. They do the procedures like amniocentesis, and then they make recommendations to the OBs on how to take care of very complex moms and babies.
Overall, if you had to estimate, what percentage of pregnancies end up in this maternal fetal medicine world?
That's a really hard thing to estimate because there's not a lot of availability necessarily to maternal fetal medicine specialists, or patients don't realize that there are these specialty clinics that they can go to. You know, we're seeing these things called maternity deserts now, where these small rural clinics are closing, and it's creating, you know, a big problem for these patients to get good access to care. And so these MFM clinics are usually at tertiary care centers, and then they also sometimes are private practice. If patients, you know, aren't sure whether they're going to be seen by one, they could look up like local maternal fetal medicine doctors to see, you know, how far away they are. But generally speaking, you know, if you live near a large city, there's probably a maternal fetal medicine doctor in the vicinity of that. I would say out of all of the deliveries that the hospital that I work at does a month, I would say about 75% of those patients have come through our clinic for one reason or another.
Okay, and they may, of course, not represent the typical percentage in a small community hospital that doesn't have access to those resources. And we are describing the situation in the United States where our maternal fetal medicine care or our obstetrical care doesn't always represent the quality of care that we should be able to deliver given the resources that are in this country. We lag behind many developed countries. And that's a source of concern. We have unnecessary women who are dying, unnecessary fetuses who are dying, that creates the need for the kind of topic that we are discussing today of providing high quality maternal fetal medicine care.
Absolutely.
Now, I know that you have in your background working as a labor and delivery nurse. Can you differentiate for our listener, what is the difference between maternal fetal medicine and labor and delivery?
So I worked in labor and delivery for about 6 years. And in labor and delivery, we focus on the here and now. We focus on getting those patients from pregnant to delivered. And, you know, sometimes they end up staying for prolonged hospitalizations. You know, if the bag of water breaks prematurely, they're there. They can be there for weeks at a time. But there's a lot of things that I learned in maternal fetal medicine that I wasn't necessarily taught in labor and delivery. And that is the antenatal management of these patients. So taking care of these very medically complex moms and babies before they get to that point. For example, taking care of and managing a mom that has, you know, poorly controlled diabetes, or the science behind intrauterine growth restriction and what that does to the placenta. Those aren't really things that I learned in labor and delivery. It wasn't until I went into the maternal fetal medicine clinic that I, you know, really learned the ins and outs of these complex medical situations.
You mentioned a couple. What are some other medical conditions that can cause a patient to need the oversight of the clinic where you work?
So we see a lot of patients for history of prior poor outcomes. So they may not have anything wrong with their current pregnancy or any concerns, but they've had a history of it, like a history of preeclampsia or a history of preterm delivery or a shortened cervix. We see people that have, you know, placenta problems like placenta previa or placenta accreta syndrome. We see moms that have underlying health problems like heart, lung, endocrine, GI, brain, kidney, problems that can cause complications in their pregnancy. We also see moms that have multiple, you know, medical issues involving multiple systems that are just very sick in general. Sometimes the mom's perfectly healthy, but we see the baby because of birth defects or chromosomal problems. We also monitor healthy babies that might just need a little bit of a closer supervision, like twins, triplets, or even higher gestations.
As you're giving us those examples, I'm thinking there are certainly moms in communities who need your services but can't access them or won't access them. And I'm thinking about some women who struggle with substance abuse who don't get prenatal care, and yet they are high-risk moms.
Yeah, that is actually a large population of the patients that I see. There, you know, is such an underserving of our patients right now for mental health crises after COVID, you know. It's just been a really big problem that we've seen. I think in every type of area of care, medical care, is the problems that come along with, you know, mental health issues, substance abuse, depression. Those are all problems that impact pregnancies. And, you know, we definitely do see that. But sometimes there is a problem getting those patients in to get the care that they need and that they deserve because of, you know, fear of being treated differently or, you know, fear of losing their baby because of things that they're struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lot of work to do as a culture, as a country, as a world to extend the helping hand to people struggling with mental health problems. I'm a careful reader of People magazine. My window on the world, I don't watch TV, I don't look at movies, but I keep track of what's going on in the entertainment world. And I see that that People Magazine specifically has made a concerted effort to share stories of people struggling with mental health problems, including some stars who have in their backgrounds histories of bipolar disease, of depression, of suicidal behavior, of abuse, to help individuals feel not so alone when it comes to managing those problems.
Yeah. And, I think that there's a big stigma around it. And I think it's great, the more people sharing, the more help that could potentially become available to others, because then other people are willing to open up and explain what they've gone through as well.
Well, let's travel down the hallway back to your clinic. And I know that for many of us who went to nursing school a while back, as you can tell from my gray hair, it's been a while since I got out of nursing school. The prenatal testing that was available in even 20 years ago was much more limited than it is now. Can you take us through the kind of testing that a woman would undergo who would come into the type of clinic that you're involved in?
Sure. So, maternal fetal medicine clinics sometimes have a genetic counselor there. So we do offer genetic screening testing for patients, and those are the nuchal translucency tests, which is usually done before 14 weeks of pregnancy. And that's looking at the thickness of the baby's neck. It's testing for chromosomal abnormalities. We also offer the amniocentesis later in the pregnancy if, something comes up on ultrasound or if other blood tests come back as an elevated risk to have other chromosomal problems. And then there's the CVS testing, which is taking a little tissue sample of the placenta and testing that for chromosomal issues. Some MFM clinics are also OB clinics, and so they do offer OB care. So some patients are getting their prenatal labs there through them. Baseline hypertension labs, monitoring for, pre-pregnancy diabetes by, testing a hemoglobin A1C, the sugar test, drinking the sugary drink. Those are all still, tests that are done, on top of the maternal fetal medicine genetic offerings that we have.
Some of these sound like they are simple blood tests. Some of them sound a bit more invasive. Are there risks associated with the more invasive tests?
Oh, absolutely. There's a risk for infection. There's a risk for, preterm delivery. The risks are very low. We usually start off with the most least invasive, which is cell-free DNA testing, where they can, test mom's blood via a blood test, and then they look for actual pieces of DNA of the baby in there. Of the baby's DNA. And that is, it can be done as early as, 9 or 10 weeks, I believe. And that looks at the amount of chromosomes that a baby has. And it can give us a pretty sensitive answer as to whether or not the baby has, a couple of the things we're looking for. And if it comes back at an elevated risk, that's still not diagnostic of whether the baby has it. The only diagnostic testing, that we would be offering would be an amniocentesis to draw the fluid out of the belly of the mother and test the chromosomes that way. But we certainly start with the least invasive and then go up to, the most invasive.
And Savannah, earlier in the podcast, you mentioned ultrasounds, a wonderful tool that certainly has enabled us to peer into the belly of our pregnant mom. I should add that my mother had twins in 1952. An ultrasound did not exist, and the doctor did not know that she had twins. until she got into the delivery room. And one baby was delivered, and then they said, "Oh my goodness, there's another baby in there too."
I have been in a surprise like that before, actually, in labor and delivery.
Well, I didn't think those surprises happened anymore, Savannah. This was something that was, over 60 years ago.
Yeah, this patient didn't have any prenatal care, and she came in through the ER delivering, and she had twins very prematurely. So she was probably about 25 weeks when she delivered, and we delivered one, and then the next one came right after. Oh my goodness, what's going on? So, yeah.
Well, 25-week babies have a lot of risks stacked up against them.
Absolutely, but thank goodness for NICU. So
Yes, indeed.
they're there in a flash.
So we have ultrasound that will tell us all kinds of things about this fetus. What are some of the things that it can pick up?
Before we continue with the show, I'd like to share this special announcement with you. I wrote my book, Painless Editing and Proofreading, to help share what I've learned in my 50 plus years of writing. One of the most important lessons that I learned was first, do nothing. Writing coaches and teachers are unanimous about this rule. Allow some time between finishing the rough draft and beginning editing. How long? For a short piece, you might wait a day or two. For a book-length work, wait at least a few weeks. You want to be able to look at your writing with a fresh perspective. Here's how to build your editing muscles. Editing a book-length manuscript will be much easier for you if you've edited and published shorter pieces. You'll have much less difficulty editing 1,000 words of text than facing the work of editing 30, 40, or 60,000 words in a manuscript. It's much easier to move text around and find important points you may have overlooked, and the technical editing is much less tedious. Short works build your editing muscles. In addition, if you get negative comments on something into which you don't invest much of yourself, you can recover more easily. That advice won't help you if you've written the first draft of a book without that warm-up period. Instead, I suggest a different plan. Unless you have a contract to publish your book by a certain date, or if you have some other compelling reason for getting it into print, take a break. Start a blog. You're probably going to want to have one anyway, so you can publicize your book and get to know other authors. You also want to build a mailing list, start a newsletter. You'll get some solid writing and editing experience in both of these cases. You can then come to your book editing with greater confidence. You'll learn many other ways to make this editing process easy by reading Painless Editing and Proofreading. Get it today at lnc.tips/creating series. Now let's return to the show.
So we can look at ultrasounds on people that have, histories of things going on. So if you have a history of cervical insufficiency or preterm labor, we can monitor the cervical length of the baby, or I'm sorry, of the mom, up until about, 24 weeks or so. We'll do ultrasounds to kind of take a measurement to see how far it is, if it's opening up when she bears down. We also do the full anatomy ultrasounds, which is looking at all of the important organs on the baby, the heart, the brain, the lungs, the placenta. A lot of people call that one the gender ultrasound. We're looking at a lot more than the gender, but it's usually done around 20 to 22 weeks. We do look at Doppler studies, which can look at the blood flow in the umbilical cord, to and from baby. We also look at the blood flow through the baby's brain, which can be an indicator of anemia. We can also do growth measurements to see how the baby is growing throughout the pregnancy. They're a little bit shorter ultrasounds. We're taking measurements of the long bones, the head, the belly. It goes into a nice equation to give us a guesstimate of, how big the baby is. We can also do full ultrasounds of the baby's heart, which are called fetal echoes. So we're looking at a lot of different connections to the heart. We're looking at the blood flow through the heart. We're looking at all of the four chambers and a lot of different detailed ultrasounds if or ultrasound views there. If we see something abnormal, then those babies will be referred on to a pediatric cardiologist. We also do what's called a biophysical profile, and that is just an ultrasound to look at the overall well-being of the baby. And we can do that for a number of reasons. Sometimes patients get those even weekly. So lots of different ultrasounds. It's not just, one kind. There's a lot of different things that we can see and that we're looking for.
And I know when something goes wrong, and there is a retrospective look back at prenatal testing to see if there were warning signs. What kinds of significant warning signs could show up on an ultrasound?
So we're looking, at the detailed anatomy of the baby to make sure that everything was developed appropriately. We're looking at the growth measurements. The growth measurements are something that I pay very close attention to. If a baby is big, like greater than the 99th percentile, or small, greater than the 10th percentile, those can be red flags that that baby is at risk for a poor outcome. I look at the chest measurement, which is sometimes called the AC, and those are, an indicator. If it's very big, those babies are at risk for a dystocia, for getting stuck, coming out of the birth canal. And then also, if it's very small, if the chest measurement is small, those babies, could have growth restriction or something could be going on with the placenta, causing it to not grow appropriately. Sometimes in the ultrasound report, we see, different recommendations from the doctor. There's a clinical summary, and there's always a lot of really good information in there. I think a lot of people just look at it real quick and then go on to the next piece of, information in the medical records, but the ultrasound report has some really good information to it.
And I would assume that if there's warning signs that this is going to be a big baby, that there's discussion about doing a C-section rather than letting this woman try to deliver vaginally.
Yeah, that is a very good conversation that needs to be had, between the OB provider and the patient, and determining, what number pregnancy it is for her. Does she have a large enough pelvis to deliver a baby that size? What is the threshold going to be for delivery? Do we, start labor, see, how well it progresses and know that there's a big baby in there? It's a difficult conversation, but that's definitely something that needs to be addressed with the patient, and the patient needs to have that informed consent to know that, yes, this I have a big baby, and this is what could happen if I try to deliver vaginally.
Take us through what happens when there is something that shows up as a red flag. What should be done with that information? You've given us an example of the big baby, but does the physician have this conversation? Does the nurse have the conversation? How do you prevent that conversation from slipping through the cracks? And I have a framework specifically of, I can think of abnormal test results that get filed away. No one has the conversation. Nobody appears to have looked at it. And then there's a tragedy later on, not just confined to what we're talking about today, but many types of abnormal lab results can slip through the attention of the people who should be looking at it, and then they don't take the appropriate action because they claim they never saw it.
Right. So There is, a big change going underway with the electronic medical record system now and patients' access to their records. And now all of our ultrasound reports are released to the patient before the OB doctor even gets to see them. So patients are having access to that. I think that that's really important for them to be able to ask questions and to advocate for themselves and to be involved in their care. But I think it's, the physician's responsibility to have those difficult conversations when something abnormal is found, and for the patient to understand the implications of those abnormal findings. For example, if we're doing an ultrasound on a woman who's had multiple C-sections, she's already had four, she's been fine with them. This is another pregnancy. She feels okay. She may not realize, the risk involved having another one, especially if she has a placenta previa now. She could have a placenta that is growing abnormally into her uterine wall, making it very high of a risk for placenta accreta or placenta increta or percreta, where it grows, through the uterine wall into other organs. And having those conversations and explaining to her what the risk is, but then following up on it, having her come back, watching it, having her understand why she's coming back is so important. And I think that that is a piece that I, take on as a nurse, is like having those conversations with the patient. Because yes, the doctor goes in and explains all that to her. But then as a nurse, you're kind of always like reinterpreting to the patient, like, okay, yes, this is what the doctor meant by that. And, what other questions do you have? Because when somebody tells you that there could be something wrong in your pregnancy, a cloud kind of goes over your head. It's a really difficult thing to take in, to think about, the risks that are involved now. And so sometimes patients aren't hearing things, the first time it's being said. So making sure that the doctor that's there, that's reading the ultrasound, is giving that information to the patient, that the patient is getting that information in their medical record, that the OB is following up on that information that was received, saying, yeah, yes, you have this, big risk that, needs to be addressed at delivery. You're going to have to deliver early because of, this potential placenta problem that we've noticed. And then, the follow-up care is so important, and making sure that there's a plan in place. That's one of the things I do as an MFM nurse, is I help make sure that there is a plan in place for these patients. So if a patient has a placenta problem, like placenta accreta, where the placenta is abnormally adhered to the uterine wall, she needs to, know that, this is a big risk and what she should do if she starts bleeding. The labor and delivery unit needs to know that we have a patient with this issue that could be coming in at any point. She needs to have, an evaluation done with anesthesia to talk about, here's, what could happen with this delivery. She might meet with interventional radiology to talk about, different things that can be done for the arteries before she goes in to deliver. And then the plan for follow-up, having a placenta accreta, the typical like cure for it, because of the high risk of maternal morbidity or mortality, is a hysterectomy, so loss of future fertility. So having everybody on board to really understand the plan and what can be done, ahead of time to prevent this poor outcome.
We talked about some of the red flags that can show up in ultrasound, and certainly you've shared some of the most serious types of issues that can come up related to the placenta. What are the red flags that would show up in other kinds of prenatal testing that should cause the team to say, hey, this is a big issue. We need to be proactive in dealing with it?
So The recommendations that were put in the patient's chart, I am looking to see, are those recommendations being followed? Is the patient adhering to those recommendations? Because, this is important for both plaintiff and defense cases. Did the doctor educate the patient very well, and the patient just chose not to come for her appointments or chose to stop taking her insulin, during her very complex pregnancy? I make sure that, things were followed up on in the chart. Sometimes those recommendations are missed. So I look back to see, what type of antenatal testing the patient had. Did she have non-stress tests that were indicated because of the findings in her chart or because of her risk factors? Did she go to those appointments? Did the patient do exactly what they were told and they still had a poor outcome? Yeah, that can totally happen. And I look to see, what was the cause of this poor outcome? Was it a shoulder dystocia? So were there fundal height measurements listed in her prenatal record that matched, the approximate gestational age that she was supposed to have? Was the baby, measuring large, early on that was potentially missed? Did she have an ultrasound? When was the last ultrasound that she had, and how big was the baby during that ultrasound? Sometimes, it can be really simple things that are missed that needed to be, followed up on as far as, lab work. Did she ever have a glucola test to see if she had gestational diabetes? What was that test? Did she fail it? Did she check her sugars? Did the doctor review her sugars? Did she have an appointment with the diabetes educator to understand, what happened in her pregnancy and how well controlled her blood sugars were throughout? So, sometimes if patients have like a history of preeclampsia, early on we do baseline lab work to make sure that it doesn't trend up later on. We want to see what happened early in the pregnancy as like a baseline. And I look to see, was that baseline lab done? Did the patient have a history of, protein in her urine her whole pregnancy? Is this a new finding? And I look to see, when the patient comes in complaining of a headache or visual disturbances or right upper quadrant pain or sudden increase in swelling, did she have the appropriate lab work ordered? Was it done? Did she have, the appropriate follow-up for that? Did she have her blood pressure evaluated? Did they pay close attention to that? And so those are all the things that I'm really looking at in the chart to make sure that there is a good outcome. Or, in hindsight, if there was a poor outcome and I'm reviewing it as a legal nurse, those are the types of things that I'm looking for to see, the missing puzzle pieces. Where did this fall apart?
And I can assure you, Savannah, that the person who's listening to this who might have thought, oh, I could pick up what I need to know about OB in order to evaluate this case, is saying, how can I reach Savannah, who can serve as my consultant or my expert or my behind-the-scenes resource to help me work through a case? What would be the best way for them to reach you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, Savannah June, June like the month. That's my name. You can find me on there. My business is Savvy Legal RN. I'm working on a website, so it's www.savvy, SAVVY, legalrn.com. So you can definitely reach out to me there. I'm happy to help, any of the other LNCs that are looking at these OB cases. I'm happy to, take a peek or answer any questions you might have. I'm happy to sub a case or to take it on completely.
Thank you, Savannah. I appreciate your expertise. You've made us realize all the complexities, and probably we've just seen a tiny corner of the complexities and the information that you have at your disposal from working in this area for so long and seeing how care can result in great outcomes and care can result or lack of care can result in some pretty tragic outcomes. Thanks for being a guest on Legal Nurse Podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me.
And for you who's been watching this on Legal Nurse Business YouTube channel, be sure to give us thumbs up or a thumbs down, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment about what you learned from Savannah's podcast. We broadcast weekly new episodes with new guests, and we would love for you to subscribe so that you keep getting notified of our new episodes. We'll be back next week with a new guest, new topic. And in the meantime, give everything you can to help your attorney clients so that they are successful in representing their clients. Thanks so much. Coming up next, you're going to hear from Ruth Pierce, who is a person who works as a reviewer, a field reviewer for a national accreditation company and has extensive experience in critical care and emergency type clinical settings. Our topic is congestive heart failure. We know that this is one that can lead to readmissions and a great deal of effort and expense within the healthcare system if it's not properly managed. Ruth, what were some of the key topics that we covered related to congestive heart failure?
Yes, Pat. Some of the things that we discussed were, what are clinical practice guidelines? How do you know when they come out? What do they include? How are they important to the clinician, bedside clinician, as well as the providers? How do you find out about them? How do you stay up to date when guidelines come out? How are they important to local clinicians and also globally? And then we also talked about how are clinical practice guidelines developed? Who is involved in that development? What is the collaboration? What is the timeline for new guidelines? When can you expect new ones coming out? And then probably lastly is the implication. So what is the implication for both clinicians, practitioners who do not follow guidelines in management of care? And then what's the implication for the legal nurse consultant and their work and how they can review that?
All that in 30 minutes. Can you believe it? Be sure to listen to Ruth Pierce's podcast on the topic of clinical practice guidelines for congestive heart failure. You'll learn a lot, whether or not you've got a case involving congestive heart failure or not. The process that she describes in this podcast is one that you can use in researching the current clinical practice guidelines in effect at the time of the care, and to get a bigger understanding of how these things come about, and also whether all hospitals and providers are expected to follow this, or whether you get an excuse if you're in a smaller rural hospital. Ruth answers that question. You need to come to the podcast to find out the answer. Ruth Pierce and clinical practice guidelines coming up next on Legal Nurse Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.